Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to part two of my talk with Tom Reynolds, a theologian, on the topic of the theology of disability and the theology of suffering. Specifically in this episode, we tackle theodicy, which asks the questions of why a sovereign God would allow suffering. See if I can figure out a sort of simple way to say this. For someone who would say, you know, why would God allow someone to be born disabled? Or why, you know, because they have to suffer and their family has to suffer. And that, you know, of course these why questions are all, you know, I've always thought maybe I should stop asking why questions, but I mean, we're allowed to obviously ask them because the Psalms are full of that, but also they don't tend to stay helpful. They tend to, you know, maybe go to a bad place or go to a place that grows our faith. But for people who, I mean, I've run into this too, on all kinds of, in all kinds of ways of suffering, for people who are agnostic or struggling with God or atheists, that they'll say, you know, what kind of God would have your son be born like that so that he suffers rejection and hardship, and then also you do. That, you know, I'm kind of amalgamating a bunch of things. No one's ever said that, but in that sense, like as a theologian, how would you answer something like that?
Well, in five easy steps. No, I think those are the why questions, and in a certain sense, they're unanswerable in terms of clean, tidy, packaged answers. I think it's messy, and answers are always ongoing and evolving, and so because human life evolves and our conceptions of what God is are tied to our finite perceptions in the world, right? And so I guess as a caveat before saying anything, the answers are always limited and open to further and ongoing revision. Having said that, the first response would be to a person who says, why would God cause such suffering in your son and you? I would want to reframe the question to say, what is it that allows you to frame my son's experience as well as my experience only in terms of suffering? So that continues the problem of sort of making over people with disabilities into problems, that the sum of a life is only about suffering. And the suffering is attributed to them by somebody else that deems it suffering, as if to say, oh, that's worthy of pity in terms of condescension. And if I were in that place, I would only be in a position of suffering. And so, and writers have written on this, so I'm not just, can't take the credit for these ideas. And certainly that, you know, suffering does happen and is real. But what about human life doesn't involve suffering in different and various dimensions? And so in one way, the suffering of human life isn't just in physical difficulties, but in the social processes of exclusion that set up barriers for the full participation of a person. So in redirecting the question, I would also suggest, how is it that we, and we by we I mean faith communities, set up barriers that cause suffering for the families and children that live with disabilities? Because in some ways the suffering is social. But I realize that redirecting the question is not answering the question in one way too. It's about probing deeper for me. And one of the questions in the book, Vulnerable Communion, that I really wrestled with was, if God is creator and the world is good, then what about these questions of suffering and evil? And theologians like to call these kinds of questions theodicy. That is, if God is all good and all powerful, then certainly God would want to and can eradicate all forms of evil and suffering. And it's perplexed humankind since the conceptions of deities in a variety of different religions. And so, I couldn't even scratch the surface, but one of the things that I tried to do in the book was rethink what a good world might be. And a good world is going to be, created good in terms of its interdependency, in terms of the vulnerability and fragileness and of life that holds up, each event as precious in some way. And human beings being created in the image of God mirrors that preciousness in a way. And if everything were created in a certain sense perfect and non-relational, that would prevent all other kinds of what we know as a good world from being possible. And so in the book, I like to say the creation is good, and that means fragile, and sometimes, fault lines move, and they're horrific, and human beings participate in some senses create, like climate change, conditions for horrible things to happen and are responsible. But it moves the question out of, does God cause, as if God's direct, will is involved in every event to determine them, as if everything is determined according to certain precepts, to rather maybe God's will is unfolding in a variety of ways, in mysterious ways, but fragileness and preciousness of life comes in a variety of shapes and sizes, and things can happen that are genuinely tragic, and it's our calling as human beings to live into and to participate into the betterment of the world, and working towards this reign of God that's finally something that Christians hope for. And so it's a complex question, and I'm sorry if I'm not even being clear here in my answer, but I think the attribution of suffering means that somehow every event is caused. And I think of the example in John 9 in the gospel, where Jesus encounters and the disciples encounter a blind person, and the disciples' first reaction is, who sinned that this person be born blind? As if disability in terms of blindness is a curse. And Jesus basically says, none, but this, so the glory of God can be revealed. And then Jesus heals the person. And so the story is less about, curing than it is about showing Jesus as the Messiah. And the story also goes against the grain of wanting to find a reason for everything, like disability is bad and there must be either a curse or a greater something that we can figure out that God has in mind. And I'm thinking that those are dead-end roads. I like to think of God's mysterious presence in all things and creation as vulnerably interdependent, which means that things are fragile and precious, and their very preciousness sometimes can be shattered. And that's something that human beings then are called to work against and trying to do betterment. And so, I'm sorry for the long-winded way of trying to get around those questions, but those why questions are important, but in a certain sense, secondary to the real act of making good on the call to live out a loving life together as human beings.
Now that's a wonderful answer, because it digs in deeper past the question. And I've been very informed by N.T. Wright and the problem of evil, and as he tackles suffering. And I think as you were mentioning in the parable of, or not the parable of Jesus, but the healing that happens with Jesus, that sometimes we think that story is about healing, and sometimes we think it's about cure and healing, and no one's at fault. Sometimes stuff just happens. But I wonder if it's also that Jesus' answer to the problem of suffering was to do something about it, and that's actually the question that we wind up asking God, you know, how could you let this happen, or why did you let this happen, or whatever those questions can sometimes, how we formulate them. But that mm-hmm. the answer is the answer we are really need to be, we don't realize we're actually asking ourselves, is that you know, what could I do? Like, and sometimes it's just presence, sometimes it's just, you know, how could this happen to this family, instead of what would ease their suffering? What is there, some little thing I could do? Could I come over and, you know, wash their dishes while they get a moment's peace, or whatever, you know, whatever it is that part of what I believe that N.T. Wright talks about is stepping into human suffering, that God never, God in the incarnation of Jesus doesn't step out of the suffering, he steps right into it and takes it on head on, and takes in ultimately the full brunt of evil and suffering upon himself. But that's not just a nice thing he did for us, but that's our model, you know, that's what we have to do. And so, you know, it gives us an opportunity to actually try to, in some small way, eliminate suffering in our little corner of the world, or at least take a crack at it.
Yeah, and it's incarnational rather than simply cerebral in the sense of answering a problem intellectually from a distance. It engages and seeks transformation as God did with humankind in, you know, in the incarnation and revealing the divine life in the midst of the fleshly fragility of our human existence. I mean, that paradox, that mystery challenges the kind of intellectualizing that can happen. And I wouldn't want to say the why questions are wrong either, because the very fact that they come to our lips signifies a kind of dis-ease and unsettledness, which can be productive if directed into transformational kinds of channels. And so I like the why questions, and I always encourage people to ask them, because first of all, God's bigger than our questions, and we should feel free to engage in dialogue with God and each other about God. And secondly, because it then, as you say, calls us to live into the world, okay. to live into the lives of the people we engage, who ask, you know, in a certain sense, where are you? Mm-hmm. And our response can be, here I am, as you say, in presence, not just answers, but in real lived, incarnate being with. And I like the word, it's a kind of hyphenated word, I guess, being-with, because that strikes me as the heart of incarnational living. God comes to humanity in being with, in the form of Jesus, and our call as followers of Jesus is to live out that being with in lives of transformational, you know, attentiveness along with each other. So yeah, I really resonate with the way you frame that. And I think a lot of folks have written on that. I try to, you know, in my very first chapter in the book, sort of criticize theodicy questions in a certain way. And then the last couple of chapters try to frame the theme of the vulnerable creation, where stuff just happens. And God is there in the midst of it. And in many cases, God's own presence is us to each other. So I like the being present theme a lot. In fact, that's figuring pretty prominent in this book on care I'm working on. Care isn't so much doing for, but it's being with.
Audited a class at the same school I went to, specifically the theology of disability. One of the fascinating projects we had to do was have a mentor for, I think, 6 weeks, or maybe it was 9 weeks, that had a disability and be mentored by this person. And I was actually mentored by a teenage boy who was nonverbal, which was really interesting. And I didn't want my son to be my project. I wanted to have a new experience. But in that class, it was revealed that 1 in 5 families encounters disability on a regular basis, whether it's someone in a wheelchair, illness, or intellectual disability. That actually affects 1 in 5 families, but you really won't find them in church. It's like only, I think it's, I don't know if the statistics are completely accurate, but it's only like 20% will come on a regular basis because it's just too hard. It's just too much of a stress for them to figure out everything to make sure that can happen. And of course, that's hasn't been our situation. We've always been very regular attenders of church because we really thought that Nathan was going to have to figure out. Nathan was going to have to figure it out, and it might be a little hard on everyone, but that eventually it would work. You know, eventually it would work, and I think it went fine. But in the sense of helping people prepare, whether they are part of Christian communities or they are leaders in Christian communities, you know, I'm sure this is part of what you do in your teaching, but you know, what are some of the things that you tell people training to be pastors or to come alongside people? Like, what do you think are some things that they could do to get started on the right track with these issues?
Particularly with families and so forth, and people with disabilities.
Right, and as far as offering care instead of cure, and like, where could they start if they feel like they haven't had too much experience with interacting with people with disabilities or knowing what to do or what to start first? Or
yeah, that's a really good question, and it's in my own teaching. You know, the question about training ministers to come alongside people in their caring relationships is an important one, and there are courses at Emmanuel that deal with that particularly. But as a theologian, I teach a class in mission, I teach a class intro to theology, and in both those classes, I like to frame, as I said earlier, theology as lived. And it's a practical wisdom that emerges in relationships of caring regard with other people, not just in the halls of a seminary or in the secluded den of reading, even though that's also a kind of cultivating space for these things. But theology in its full sense is lived out. And part of what that means then is reimagining retooling our imaginations to look at the world differently, and to read scripture perhaps differently than it's been read before in ways that have ended up being harmful for people, like the healing narratives, for example, or disability is cursed, or even metaphors of blindness and deafness, which the language itself can become a barrier. So I think of barriers, first of all. Barriers to real, genuine participation of all in a community can come in the form of not just spatial barriers, like, you know, inaccessible buildings, but in terms of attitudes and language and the way we communicate in our practices, like, you know, asking before assisting somebody or asking somebody, how might I be of help, rather than presuming that you know better before encountering a person who you project your own assumptions about their experience, rather than first listening and asking. And so, you know, dismantling barriers of perception becomes huge in that task. So I challenge people to ongoingly be open to being unsettled and being disrupted, and then attending to people before inserting your own will or what you think is God's will into their own experience. And then I guess further issues involved, and they kind of feed out of that, is that ministry doesn't have to be deficit focused. To the quote needy unquote, but possibility focused, recognizing people with disabilities and their families not just as faulted needs to drain resources of faith communities, which tends to be the model, but instead as resources and gifts to be welcomed ongoingly. And that turns things upside down, really, in faith communities, which tend to be, you know, what program can we create to serve those other people who are needy? Rather, what can we do together, including the voices of the margins, of those people that tend to be disregarded or overlooked, or whose stories somehow don't matter in the community, really focusing on listening to those voices. And so in that sort of space, genuine hospitality can happen, not just for people, but with people, and attentiveness to people as sites of wisdom for creating and contributing to the belonging that we all aspire to in our communities. And the end result is that, you know, I liked my, one of my favorite verses these days is 1 Corinthians 12:25, that where Paul talks about members having the same care for one another in faith communities. And I like the same care piece, that everybody is capable of contributing and caring, which opens up vulnerable, interdependent relationships of giving and receiving that I see as what faith communities are called for. In fact, in the richest sense, that's living out the image of God. So building shared affinity rather than some people just doing for others who are seen as needs, that shared affinity really is what ministry is about, cultivating a people in terms of the togetherness that I have, at least in the few glimpses I've had of it in my own life journey, is the richest way of being alive and being human. So some of those things I try to convey in my theology classes as what theology is all about, turning things upside down, both in a prophetic sense, but also in terms of a sense that goes beyond dismantling barriers and actually fosters the kind of transformative communion. I mean, what I call in my book, vulnerable communion of being together. So, I mean, I could go on for another half hour. I'll stop there. Sorry, I've talked too much.
No.
But those are the kinds of things, I guess you're touching on why I'm passionate and why I feel teaching is a vocation. Because I feel like faith communities really can live into this vision much more, robustly, I guess, than we tend to do.
Yeah, I was a guest speaker at one of these classes on theology of disability after a couple years I had taken it, and I had, what was really a beautiful thing, the professor invited me to come as a substitute and invited my son to come too, so people could meet him and see what he's like. And and I asked him if he wanted to do a presentation. Now, he didn't want to talk very much, but he loves trains, and so he wanted to talk about trains. Wow. And I thought it would be a great inroad, right, for them to get to know him. But when he wasn't there ahead of time, I explained, you know, what autism was, and obviously it's different in every individual, but because a lot of people were not very familiar, or they thought it would be like a Rain Man situation. Every autistic person is something like Rain Man.
Get that too.
Is he really good at math? And like, not really. But so I had said to them, we had baked cookies, and I had said to them, when I bring in Nathan, we're going to have a break, and when I bring him in, I've asked him to serve you cookies and lemonade or whatever. And I'm doing it so that you understand that when you are not just serving people with disabilities, but allowing them to work alongside you, it gives them dignity and it gives you dignity. It gives you your humanity back and it gives them their humanity back, because you are making a decision that there isn't a distinction between us. We're equal, and we're equal in God's eyes. We're equal in each other's eyes. And that, how big of a deal that is, that as these people, these are going to be counselors and pastors and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they were visibly moved. And then when he was serving them, they were grateful, you know, in a different way. And if there was anything I could say to people, in whether leaders or just in Christian communities, is that you have to decide if they're equal to you or not. And then move from there, because that's really sort of what we're talking about, that we will, that not just our projects or charity cases or someone to pity, but that even though they seem different, and they are, and they might have, they're more vulnerable perhaps, or maybe they have more special needs, that we're not really talking about different people. We're not really talking about different levels of humanity. And I, you know, that's just one of those things that you, maybe I would have not understood that if I didn't have a son with some of these issues.
Yeah, that's powerful. And Chris doesn't want to come present. I've invited him. Like, nah, that's your gig, Dad. But it is true. I think the equality piece is important. But equality can sometimes be seen as sameness. And I love the way you told the story, because differences doesn't mean a hierarchy. You know, our differences are equal. And in a certain sense, people come in all kinds of ranges of experiences and bodies. And to be open to that as a way of being authentically and genuinely human, yeah, it's part of the task. That was nicely said.
Well, I will probably wrap it up, because I'm sure I've taken up plenty of your morning here.
Chat,
but maybe we can check back in, especially as you get closer to finishing up your book. I'd love to just continue the dialogue with you, because it's of course dear to my heart. So I get to pick what I want to talk about. But it's also is just so useful for others, I think, in so many encounters and so many settings that we develop the grace for each other, in no matter if it's for typically developing people or if it's for people who have limitations. But it's a really potent it is a practical theology, and so I'm just so grateful that you would spend some time discussing it, and hopefully this won't be our final conversation.
Oh, it was great to talk with you. Thanks for the invitation. As you know, my thinking on this is constantly evolving and being reshaped by life experience, so it would be fun to talk again and hear how you're evolving and growing too.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tom, and I really appreciate that you have sent me some musical material to play, because that is that is a treat. And I was clapping, you know, when I saw it come in. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got some music. This is great.
Well, it's my therapeutic other life, I like to say. I was a musician in Nashville, Tennessee for years before pursuing, while I was pursuing a theology degree at Vanderbilt. So music is near and dear, and it's a language that communicates in ways much deeper than words. So I try to keep up my musicality, even though I don't get to do it as much.
And your son seems to appreciate music as well.
He does. Yeah, he's into all sorts of alternative bands. He can tell the stories of all the bands and plays me some stuff that are not really my preference, but he's really into music, and loves all kinds of music.
Well, thank you again, and I will. Once this goes, in a few weeks, I will make this a live podcast, and then I'll have some show notes at my website that will revert back to your book and to your, should I have things sent to your school page, or is there another place that you would like people to be directed towards to find out more about you?
Oh, yeah, you can. I mean, my school page is pretty minimalist. People, if they want to email me, are welcome to. My school email, which I think you have, is pretty, that's the general way I communicate. I don't even have another email account. And I'm open to being in conversation, however. But yeah, generally, the website there at school is a great way to sort of find out, even though it doesn't detail all the things that I do. Part of my ongoing work is in building interfaith dialogue, which is a topic also near and dear to my heart. And you know, promoting dialogue is obviously related to a theology of disability too. But so I do some other work there, and I'm starting to write more in terms of creativity, the arts, and theology. But And I hope to do more of that eventually too.
Well, I'll be keeping track. I won't stalk you, but I will. I'll be keeping track of what you're up to.
Yeah, feel free to be in touch about whatever. And I've appreciated meeting you and hearing a little bit about the many different creative things that you're up to. That's great. And I certainly wish you well with Nathan, and hope all continues to flourish in that dimension of your life.
Thank you so much. Well, blessings to you as you continue your day, and I will be in touch pretty soon with some extra details. Thank you so much. I really hope you enjoyed the show today. Please come by sparkmymuse.com for related show notes and links and all kinds of other information. Don't forget to subscribe, and please give us 5 stars on iTunes.